let's talk about the situation of Scott Ritter. He wanted to go to St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, and the State Department has seized his passport that he was not able to go there. And for someone who has been working and who has worked with the State Department and knows how does it work, in your opinion, what was the reason behind this decision on their part?
I don't know, Nima. I haven't seen an explanation come forward. I've seen apologies for it on Twitter from people who hate Scott because Scott has it doesn't just speak his mind and speak accurately and honestly and tells the truth, but because Scott's been right about so many things going back decades. So people hate him. And there are apologists on Twitter making all kinds of excuses and rationales and, you know. So, but I've not seen an explanation from the State Department as to why it was done. Not seen anything from the Customs and Border Patrol as to why it was done. You know, Scott's been pretty clear that the officers who detained him and took his passport did not know why they were doing it. They were just told to go and get this guy, pull him out of line, take his passport, send him on his way. You know, I don't know how many times a day those officers do that. You know what I mean? So is this something that is occurs frequently? I doubt it. But then more so is the reason for this. I mean, you can only assume that the reason why Scott was not allowed to travel is because there was a decision made to limit and curtail and prevent Scott from traveling in order to suppress his free speech, that what he is saying is something that hurts the establishment, it hurts the elites, it hurts the American empire, and that cannot be permitted. And as things crumble, as things fall apart, as the American empire continues to decline, the desperation, the frustration, the anger, the fear causes it to lash out. And this is one of the things that you'll see. Well, I'm certain I bet most people who are watching and listening will agree. We are going to see more of this. It's interesting that the same day, maybe within the same day, that Scott was not allowed to travel to Russia, the Washington Post published just a god-awful smear on the gray zone that the Washington Post has since had to correct and amend and retract some things, including change the headline, which was completely, which was a lie, you know, which was a slander. You know, so it's interesting that the Washington Post publishes a big story. I mean, it's a long story, and I assume if you have a physical copy of the Post, this is front page story. You know, and they made a big deal. The Post made a big deal, and the author of it, Joseph Menn, made a big deal about how this is no longer going to be this is not behind a paywall because this is such an important story. You have to know about how Russia and Iran are funding these, you know, turncoat traitorous journalists in the United States, right? I mean, so it could be a coincidence, but you know, it might not be. And so we may be seeing more and increased efforts to suppress speech as we have. And of course, you know, behind me on the wall is Julian Assange, and you know, it goes back to that as well. This that if you not just humiliate the empire by exposing its crimes, but if you demonstrate how actually weak it is and how incompetent it is, that becomes very dangerous to the empire. And so they'll go at great lengths to prosecute you and persecute you. They want to put Julian's head on a pike as a warning to others. And I think, you know, with both the gray zone, the examples of the gray zone and Scott this week, those are things too where they are trying to intimidate, right? They're trying to produce a chilling effect. Oh, don't, if you're a journalist or a commentator, don't think about talking to press TV. Don't think about talking to Sputnik or RT because you will then be labeled as a Russian or Iranian asset, and you know, the USA Today will run a story on you or something like that, right? I mean, so you know, it could have been unconnected, but you know, I think a lot of us think, yeah, there might be some connection there.
When you look at the conflict in Ukraine, we've learned that they're reducing the duration of training to 15 days. No one in their right mind would do that. And how do you see the current situation of the Ukrainian army and why they're doing this to these Ukrainians? Anybody who has any sort of information about military service and what's going on in that area knows that it doesn't work.
Right. I mean, the manpower issues for the Ukrainian army are dire. You know, the U.S. government this week warned Americans with Ukrainian citizenship, men, male Americans who also are Ukrainian citizens, that if you go to Ukraine, you might not be able to come back. You know, so don't go. Essentially what the American government said. I mean, so you have the American government talking about this ally that they provided authorized up to $175 billion in funds for this proxy war against Russia, telling their own citizens, don't go there because you will be press ganged into the Ukrainian army and we can't help you and we're not going to help you. I mean, there are roughly about 1,800,000, 900,000, 1 million Ukrainian men of military age outside of Ukraine, and they're not coming back. The Ukrainian new Ukrainian conscription laws, right? They lower conscription to 25, which is the opposite of how in the West we do it, where we take the youngest. In Ukraine, they do it in the opposite way. So I think, you know, there is this expectation, though, in terms of the manpower issues, that at some point there will be a collapse. And how will that be prevented, I think, is the question that we're all wondering about. What are they going to do to prevent this collapse? You know, it's not just the military, Nima. It's also the economy. Last year, at some point, November, December, the Ukrainian government said there were going to be 4 million people short for labor. Right. I mean, so like their economy, they don't have enough people for their economy, you know, and I think that is, in my estimation, a greater worry is a collapse of the Ukrainian economy, a collapse then of the Ukrainian government as a result of that, that would lead to that type of catastrophe for Ukraine in the West. I think with regards to the Ukrainian army, they're estimating that we can continue to hold on and eventually we'll start bringing in more mercenaries. I think there's fanciful thoughts of like, we're going to get a Polish brigade in here. We're going to get a French brigade in here. You know, this idea of NATO troops going into takeover training. Okay, well, that's going to free up a few thousand, maybe 10,000 Ukrainians to go to the front lines. You know, not enough to make the difference. You're talking about a need for hundreds of thousands. The Russians have, I think, an estimated 300,000 troops in reserve. I mean, so this idea that Ukraine is just standing on top of a rotting floor, and it's just a question of when it's going to fall through, is something that becomes more and more, you know, that imagery becomes more and more intense every day because it becomes more likely. So this issue with manpower, I mean, again, you can send them all the weapons you want, all the munitions you want, but who's going to pull the triggers? And then to the point that you're saying about sending these troops forward into combat with the Russians after 2 weeks of training, and we've heard for quite a while now, well over a year at least, maybe longer, you know, in mainstream media, so the Guardian or the Washington Post, about Ukrainian troops receiving, you know, a very very thin a skeleton of training, essentially, hardly any training. We've heard about that for a while. And so it has to be widespread now. Maybe those were extreme cases, or the reporters were able to find some outliers, or maybe it was only a third of the two. But now we have to believe that this is happening to all the troops that are going forward. What that means, of course, is that you're not going to fight as well. I mean, that's obvious. But what it also means is that the morale for people, for the citizens of Ukraine is going to continue to deteriorate. I mean, these stories only make you more despondent. It only makes it a gloomier, more desperate. It only makes it more worrisome. We know that in March, there was a poll that found roughly an equal number, actually more, but within the margin of error, of Ukrainians wanted to negotiate an end to the war as opposed to achieving, you know, some kind of military victory. You know, I mean, so the weight of all this that's falling on the Ukrainian people, and then you hear these stories repeated over and over again of the differences in terms of you're in Kyiv, you're in you know, throughout in the urban areas in central and western Ukraine, and there are a lot of fit young men who are not in service. I mean, you see these stories over and over again, and you know, this conflict that then exists, and this is a conflict that is throughout our history as a people, right? Who goes and fights in these wars? It's the working poor, right? It's the people, it's the young men off the farms, you know, that were all out of the rural areas. And so you have that tension that exists in the society. You have half of the Ukrainian population saying that they understand why people don't want to be drafted, why men don't want to be drafted, essentially saying this war is not worth dying for. And you have essentially half of Ukrainian men saying they're not going to be drafted, they'll avoid the draft. And I mean, so I mean, all the different stories, articles, videos we see that have been coming out for quite a while now, a year, year and a half almost, of, you know, men and women avoiding essentially men, but avoiding military service. So it is a tremendous issue for the Ukrainians. I don't know how it's not the focus of discussion more here in the U.S. It gets brought up, but it gets overridden by the fact that the F-16s are coming soon. And now, you know, Emmanuel Macron he's sending Mirage fighters. They were built 30 years ago, but don't worry. This is what's going to turn the tide. These Mirage fighters that'll get there in about 15 months time, probably, or something like that. You know, I mean, so it's this avoidance of the structural issues, why this war was always going to be unwinnable for the Ukrainians, just based upon size, you know, just based whatever metric you're looking at, population, industry, size of the standing army, revenue, etc. What was the reason why this war? These were the reasons why this war was always going to be unwinnable. And I think the Ukrainian and American, the Western expectation is as long as this is the hope, this is their strategy based on this hope. As long as we continue to pump money into this, right? And NATO, there's a NATO proposal, you know, talking about essentially providing more than $30 billion a year to Ukraine for military funding. I'm still not sure if that's in addition to what the Americans would also provide. And the Americans would provide half of that NATO funding anyway, essentially. So, I mean, the amount of money, but that would make sense. You know, you're talking about providing $60 billion a year to Ukraine to provide militarily, and about $50 billion a year to keep the economy and government afloat, keep that from collapsing. So more than $100 billion. That's the hope, is that we funnel $100 billion a year into this war, we will keep this balloon inflated. Essentially, we'll keep this house of cards standing. You know, I don't think many of us would put too much, you know, bet too much money on our own, too much for our own money on that succeeding.
Yeah. Putin just said that the AFU was losing about 50,000 men a month. Do you think that in the West, in the Biden administration, in the European Union, do they consider these numbers, or they're thinking that this is a joke? That's not the reality on the battleground.
Well, I think anything that comes from the Russians is immediately dismissed by those at the senior levels of our government to our own great peril. You know, that is, again, these are political animals. And so anything coming from the other side is seen as coming from the other with a capital O, right? Your opponent, but also to someone that doesn't. I think what happens is that they receive this information and they say it's propaganda. And if you dare to go into the boss's office and present that to him or her, you're going to be seen as not loyal, that you're going to be seen as not someone who could be trusted to stay on the narrative, right? And what we have, of course, is we have a governments, the American, the British, NATO, many European countries as well, that build their policies around existing narratives. So rather than the narrative being shaped, the messaging being shaped by what your policy is, by what the reality on the ground is, you have your policies being shaped to support your existing narratives. You know, and then of course the rallies on the ground don't matter. And how you're gonna speak of the realities of the ground are of course dictated by what your narrative is. So no one's gonna go into their boss's office and be like, "Look, hey, the Russians are correct about this. The Ukrainians are losing 50,000 men." I have no idea what the casualty numbers are. That sounds high to me. But even if you're talking about 10 or 20,000 Ukrainian soldiers wounded and killed, being taken out of the line essentially per month, 10 to 20,000. That's unsustainable for the Ukrainian military. It's just is. I mean, you're talking then about a casualty rate that just cannot be your army can't stand on that. So if Putin is a quarter right, half right, that's still devastating for the Ukrainians. We know that the Americans know, though, that whatever the Ukrainians are saying is incorrect. And that is, it is that it's propaganda as well. We know this because 15 months or so ago, when the Discord leaks occurred, when that U.S. airman posted all those classified documents, particularly the briefings for the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to his video game friends, and then they got out. One of the things you could see if you were able to get through the documents, and this was a frustration, just an aside going back to our discussion on the media, right? The Washington Post received a lot of those. They got their hands on a lot of them and they refused to publish them. They only published excerpts. So we were never able really to see what was on all of those documents because the Post wouldn't release the full documents. Right. If something, if WikiLeaks had those documents, we would be able to see the whole things. So we'd have a full understanding. We'd be looking at the primary source, the raw data. Post didn't do that. One of the things you did see in one of the slides that was released was that on an estimation of the battle damage assessments, there is an asterisk, and you go down in the asterisk and well, two things. If you look at a couple of the slides, you'll see that the numbers don't add up. This slide says 1,000 Russian vehicles destroyed. This slide says 100 Russian vehicles destroyed, or whatever the numbers were. But then again, the point being originally speaking to was this idea that there was an asterisk on one of the slides. We looked at the footnote for that asterisk. It essentially said this information is coming from the Ukrainians. You know, the paraphrase, we don't trust it. We're trying to figure out how to get this information on our own. And that had to do with casualties and battle damage assessment. You know, so the 15 months ago, being briefed to the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, you know, General Milley, the American intelligence community could not tell him what losses were like on either side. So, and I know there's a lot of people out there, there's all these people on Twitter who are looking at these videos and claiming they're, you know, and that is absolutely idiotic. I could say a lot of other words that are not as polite, but it's absolutely idiotic if people think that's an accurate way to gauge what's going on the front lines, on the 600 mile long front line, you know, because you've got a dozen different drone video feeds are somehow going to make an estimation. I'll leave it at that. But, you know, I mean, so what's really happening there is we I don't think we have people who have a good feel of that. I don't think we have an American military and intelligence establishment that has a good order of battle for the Russian army. And that's why I think that you continue to see these miscalculations and what information is going to the president. Again, you have this idea that who's going to go in their boss's office and tell them something they don't want to hear. That's not how you get to the top in D.C. There's one thing about D.C. It prizes loyalty. I'll also tell you from my personal experience, when I left Afghanistan, or resigned in Afghanistan, came back, was speaking publicly, I had to go testify before the President's Intelligence Advisory Board. And it was led by David Boren and Chuck Hagel, former senators who have been on the Senate Intelligence Committee. They were both now at universities. And what they brought me in for is they say, hey, look, we're watching you. We're reading what you're saying. It's matching up with what these Army and Marine Corps officers who are coming through our universities are telling us. And it has nothing to do at all with the information that's going to President Obama about the Afghan war. Can you help us figure this out? And the reality was, is that the president was being told something that was politically skewed. We know this is also true because this is what Lloyd Austin did in 2015, when Lloyd Austin was head of Central Command. About 50 Central Command intelligence analysts, as well as maybe some outside of Central Command as well, went in to the Inspector General and saying, you know, General Austin is taking our product, our analysis, and he's changing it before he's sending it to the president, right? He's changing it to make it in line with what the political narrative is, as well as, assumingly so, what's it best for General Allen's, General Austin, excuse me, General Allen was another one we can criticize, General Austin's, you know, own career interests, right? His own personal interests. I mean, so there's an abundance of reasons to suspect that what's going to Joe Biden, what's going to Jake Sullivan, what's going to Tony Blinken is entirely cooked, incorrect propaganda, BS, however you want to describe it. Same time, too, we have to remember that Joe Biden, Jake Sullivan, Tony Blinken have their own agency, and these guys are believers in the American empire. They're also believers in the power they have, and that's the thing they believe in most. I briefed Tony Blinken when I came back from Afghanistan in 2009. Went to his office over there at the old executive building. At that point, he was Joe Biden's national security advisor, and he had a few of his staff people there and everything else, and he listened to me. He's a very smart man. He understood what I was talking about, the things I was saying to him about how the reality of what the Taliban was like, the reality of the war in Afghanistan, what surging American military presence would mean. He'd heard these arguments before. He understood them. It wasn't like I was someone with three heads sitting in front of him. And I think what occurs, what it is, though, is that for people like Tony Blinken, Jake Sullivan, Joe Biden, Republicans are the same way. What matters to them is what matters to their power. So I'm sure Blinken understood what I'm saying. He appreciated it, probably agreed with a lot of it. But when he stepped back and said, what's best for my power? What's best for this administration's power, particularly in terms of domestic politics, which is what really matters, maybe all that matters, the best thing to do is to surge in Afghanistan. You know, I mean, it's the way, same way David Axelrod and Rahm Emanuel, I'm sure in that case, they would say to President Obama, I'm sure they did say, look, President Obama, if you get out of Afghanistan and a bomb goes off in Times Square, they will hang you for it. You will not win in 2012. If you surge in Afghanistan and a bomb goes off in Times Square, and one did, you will not be blamed for it. You know, but if a bomb goes off in Times Square, they will say this is because President Obama is weak and he's running from our enemies. And so whether or not Obama agrees with what he's doing in Afghanistan for political reasons, his own domestic political benefit, he advances that war. And I think it's the same thing, too, with the cadre we have in power now. A lot of them are the same people. Joe Biden was the vice president, you know, 15 years ago. But, you know, so that all wraps around this idea of having an understanding what's going on there. And so you get to the point where, does it even matter? Do any of these facts matter? Does the reality even matter? You know, I mean, all the warnings we have heard from Russia, particularly in this last week or two, where you've seen from the top down, you know, from Vladimir Putin down through the various, you know, functionaries, in a number of different Russian ministries and organs and media outlets, all on message, do not escalate this war. We are serious. There will be consequences. And whether or not that's getting through, whether or not the Americans, the British, the rest of NATO believe their own nonsense about how, well, you know, the Russians haven't stood behind their red lines before. Why are they going to stand behind them now? When reality is that, well, the red line has always been about attacks on Russian territory. You know, it was always about using this type of weapons, munitions, material against Russian territory. It's not been about them using it on the battlefield. So the introduction of HIMARS and Abrams, and we saw escalations from the Russians' response to that. But in a sense of where we need to be very frightful, this place that we're going to may get to that we never wanted to get to, of what happens when NATO troops are killed by Russian strikes in a manner that can't be denied or hidden up or, you know, obscured. Well, we may fast be approaching that. And I think for the historians in the future, this decision-making process at the White House, at Downing Street, in Brussels. I think it's going to be a real mess for them to untangle, to figure out how the heck did the West ever come to these decisions.
Matt, if you talk about Iraq and Afghanistan, just imagine if there were governments helping Afghanis or Iraqis to fight the United States. They were so lucky that they didn't have anybody helping them to fight the United States. Less casualties.
Oh, and we complained about it, though. We made it up. Certainly when we're in Iraq. No one ever talked about, of course, because the Saudis are our allies. No one ever talked, of course, that, the Saudi insurgency, where was their funding coming from? Where was their support coming from? It was, not ever spoken about. WikiLeaks revealed it, but we knew it. I mean, I knew it before WikiLeaks occurred, that the major funding for the Taliban was coming from the Gulf monarchies. Pakistani intelligence and military providing funding as well. They were taking funding from our own contracts. So whether it was because actual shakedowns, bribes, corruption, or because like when I was in Afghanistan, one time the teachers in my province didn't get paid. Where do you think that money went to? Well, the guy who ran the schools in that province, his brother or his cousin or someone two provinces over in Wardak province was a well-known Taliban commander. So when the teachers didn't get paid, where do you think that money had gone to? So there is all that, but now we're going to blame it all on drugs, this narco terror nexus, which, as we now know, largely didn't exist. It was made up as propaganda. Towards the end of Afghanistan, there was the lies in 2018, 2019, one of the many elements of Russiagate, that the Russians were paying bounties to the Taliban to kill Americans, because ostensibly the Taliban had no reason to kill Americans unless they were bribed to do so by the Russians. Completely inane, completely asinine, and of course, completely without merit or foundation or any evidence whatsoever. Certainly go back to Iraq, just another example, because it's always the same boogeyman they're blaming. They're always trying to take away the agency from the Iraqis, take away the agency from the Afghans, to make it as though these people wouldn't be fighting us if it wasn't for, Boris and Natasha over there causing big trouble, right? They, in the sense of Iraq, more than 1,000 of our soldiers wouldn't have been killed in Iraq by Shia militias if it wasn't for the Iranians. The only reason the Iraqis had EFPs, explosive foreign penetrators, was because the Iranians gave them to them. The reality is, if you got a decent machine shop, you get about 3 hours of instruction on it, which you can find on YouTube or whatever. You can make those yourself, no problem. We used to make them when I was in the Marines. I mean, like so the this idea that you have to use the enemy you're fighting now, who has legitimate grievances for fighting you, essentially you're occupying them, but you have to use them to justify some future and larger war. And so you see that. But now we're at the point, of course, right? Now we're at the point where you do have the Russians saying, and Vladimir Putin said it this week, and it was echoed by others, that, what if we, the Americans, you're giving these weapons to Ukraine, you're using it against us in this war, you're using it now to strike against our own country, against our territory. What if we start providing weapons to those who are fighting you? And so I think the first thought everybody has is that, well, what if the Russians give missiles to the Yemenis and the Yemenis use those to sink American warships? So they fired at the Eisenhower aircraft carrier last week. What if they fired at and sunk it? There's 5,000 American sailors and Marines on those in that boat. Now you are presented with this thing, this reality that you have now made. For however long you've been trying to create this situation where you could justify war with these other countries, whether it be Iran, Russia, China, of course, is what so many in Washington, D.C. are lusting after, and now you potentially have it. And it's not going to look the way you want it, though. It's going to look in the way that you've been doing it yourself. So utilizing proxy wars, you are now going to be on the receiving end of that. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see, of course, to put it mildly, if the Russians go through with that, how they go through with it. You know, but there's certainly, I think we have gotten to that point that we didn't want to get to, something that you and I have discussed so many times, you know, this fear that you get to this point and now you're at it. And the Russians have just killed Americans. The Russians just killed British soldiers. What are you going to do? What's your response going to be? The Yemenis just sunk you know, U.S. destroyer with a Russian missile. What are you going to do? And you know what Lindsey Graham and Tom Cotton and most of Washington, D.C. is going to demand in an election year. And Joe Biden is trailing Donald Trump in the polls. You know what Donald Trump's going to be saying about this. So what does Joe Biden do? And then it comes down to what's more important for him. Almost certainly losing this election if in what his political calculation is, I don't act tough, I don't stand up to Russia, I don't respond, I am definitely going to lose the election, versus this, well, they say there's a risk of nuclear war, but I got people coming in and telling me not to, that's overestimated, that we can handle it, we can manage it, right? I mean, that's a terrifying, terrifying scenario.
Are these superpowers able to fight a conventional war with each other without going nuclear?
I don't think so. I don't, you know, you have Larry Wilkerson come on often, right? Ask Larry that question, because Larry is still involved with the war games that they do. And from what I know from Larry, from what I've read, others, these things, not always, but more often than not, go nuclear. You know, so it's not even you're talking about a 1% chance, right? Which, you know, in terms of nuclear war, 1% chance, you've got to take that as 100% chance. But you're talking about a situation where, from what I understand, and Larry can speak to this much better than me, but you're talking about more likely than not, it goes nuclear. You know, and that fear, that certainly is what dominated the Cold War. Both sides understood that. Both sides had plans to utilize nuclear weapons. You know, not at some 10th stage of the war, right? Not at, you know, step F or G or H, but at step B, you know, they were going to use nukes. And that is very chilling, of course. But you also have those who think that they can manage it. So what happens is that Joe Biden, Jake Sullivan, Tony Blinken, they are debating what to do. They're trying to figure out what to do. Russians just killed X amount of Americans. You know, they shot down an American reconnaissance aircraft, whatever, however this comes about. And the advice they're going to be getting is, as we were talking about before, advice that the information, the intelligence, it's all going to be massaged to fit the narrative. And if the narrative is a hawkish one, which, you know, everybody knows it will be, you know, it's President Obama said it himself, you know, you know, Washington, D.C. has a proclivity for war, as he said, you know, I mean, knowing that, and then who's going to come in to brief them? You know, it's going to be people like David Petraeus, it's going to be people like Ben Hodges. And this is how a lot of these decisions get made, because these political decisions are made, right? Again, with the weight, the importance of domestic politics defining and driving that decision. And then when they look to, well, but what about the military angle on this? But we really should, well, who do they bring in? They bring in Petraeus, they bring in, you know, Hodges, they bring in, you know, whoever. Austin's the Secretary of Defense. You know, can you trust that guy? You can't. He's shown that you can't trust him. I mean, but they come in and they provide that cover. So you got this former 3 or 4 star. You got Jim Stavridis coming in there and telling you, oh, no, I just wrote a book about a war with China. Trust me, we can manage this. It explains all the pitfalls. You read my book, it'll tell you how to avoid it. We can win this thing. You know, I mean, like, and so then these political types say, oh, OK, well, these admirals and generals just told me we're good to go. You know, I mean, you've had for More than a decade now, this idea within the United States military, and unfortunately, I believe the Russians have this as well, this idea of usable nuclear weapons, right? That you have a use a nuke that is such a low yield that it will serve as a warning. And this gets into that whole, this gets into this whole idea of escalate to de-escalate, which the Americans said for a long time was a Russian philosophy. It's not a Russian philosophy, it's an American philosophy. But and then so you say, okay, well, hey, we've got nuclear weapons that are 0.3 kilotons. You can dial it down to 0.3 kilotons. Why don't we utilize one of those as a demonstration? And 0.3 kilotons, just for people recognize, 15 kilotons was a Hiroshima bomb. So this is significantly less than the Hiroshima bomb. It's not even really a nuclear weapon. It's not even an atomic bomb at this point. It's really like a high-grade conventional. They'll call it something else. They'll call it an enhanced conventional weapon or some nonsense. And you can see how that type of decision-making is then made. And, if you got someone like Joe Biden, who is driven with this idea that he is standing up against a tyrant, that he is the embodiment of democracy against authoritarianism, or if you have someone like Donald Trump, who, arguably most malleable president of all time, and certainly most malleable president in my lifetime, you could see how a really, really stupid and apocalyptic decision could be made to escalate a crisis to a point of no return. To your point about if you had a conventional war where somehow you're able to get NATO forces into Ukraine and you actually have NATO and Russia duking it out in the conventional sense, firing artillery at each other, hitting each other with drones, tanks maybe shooting at each other, infantry killing one another, plane, it would escalate so quickly that you would get to that point where you'd have strikes on command and control facilities within a couple of days. It maybe even not on the first day. I can't see how it wouldn't happen on the first day, that NATO would have to do deep strikes into Russia to hit Russian command and control facilities, just as Russia would do the same towards NATO. That's how you fight a war. So right away, you'd be having these long-range deep strikes into each other's territory. And from there, it's just a question of how quickly does the doctrine dictate that you go to nuclear weapons? Again, this is why you go back to the Cold War. And both sides were ready to use nuclear weapons right away because that's what it came to, right? And then at that point, you're hoping that the idea is that somehow, after those first wave of nuke strikes, cooler heads prevail, everyone backs off and says, okay, let's all take a breath. Problem is, one, escalation theory, but also the war games have demonstrated that's not what happens, right? You keep escalating until you t reach that, you keep climbing the escalation ladder to keep to you reach that top rung, and yeah, so this is the nightmare scenario, man, that you and I weren't talking a few years ago, but say 3 years ago, we might have speculated about this. But in the last couple of years, it's not idle speculation. This is, very, very worrying analysis.
In Germany, they're talking about fighting Russia by 2029. There are two aspects to this type of argument on the part of Germany. First of all, how they can afford this kind of fight? How they gonna produce arms? How they gonna produce arm in Germany? Because we know that how dependent right now they are on China and the United States. The car production in Germany is totally dependent on China and the United States right now. And at the same time, they're talking about fighting Russia by 2029. This is the first aspect of this argument. The second part, why do you want to fight Russia? What in the world do they have with Russia? We haven't seen anything coming from Russia and Russian president and Russian Putin administration talking about they're gonna go fighting Germans. How
Right.
do you evaluate these type of comments on the part of Germans?
It is. It's crazy. Because if you go back a number of years ago, the Russian line to the Germans essentially was like, we'll sell you cheap energy, just please don't meddle in our affairs. Right. I mean, 196 or 193 nations. He asked Jeff Sachs how many there are. I always forget. But around the world, many, if not most of them, are doing terrible things to their people. You know, so why do you choose to meddle in some countries and not others? But, you know, I mean, for that was the Russian line was, you know, we'll sell you cheap energy. We want you to be on our front yard, essentially, be our front, our neighbors across the street, essentially. And you've seen the strength of the Russian economy, why the Germans wouldn't buy into that. You know, but the Germans, of course, have deindustrialized. They have made some incredibly hard to explain decisions. And the Germans, this idea of we'll be there in 2029, able to fight the Russians. I think a lot of it is their own military industries, propaganda, the desire for war for political reasons as well as for romantic reasons among many German leaders, that this time we could be the good guys, you know, as well as just the vein that's in so many of these people. What is that idea of it? It's the you know, Jordan Peterson and others talk about this. It's, you know, the psychopathy, sadism, Machiavellianism, and what's the fourth one? Narcissism, right? And that defines the personality types of those in power very often. You have that in Germany, just like you have that in the US, just like you have that in Russia, so forth. This idea that somehow they're going to be prepared to fight Russia when the German army is hollow, to put it politely, is fantasy. It also burgers into the realm of fantasy in the sense of that you can imagine a fantasy television series or a book about some country that just creates swords and spears and bows and arrows at the expense of feeding their people. You know, you know how that story would go. You know where how that TV show would end. Right? I mean, so but this idea of guns versus butter. Right. I mean, why are the German politicians so immune from that concept? But we have that here as well in the U.S. And certainly you have leaders throughout Europe. I mean, this proposal to increase GDP spending on the military to over 2% to 3% in NATO. We have the chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee here in the United States, Roger Wicker, wrote a big op-ed that got a lot of attention last week in the New York Times about how the United States in the next 5 years needs to increase its military spending from 3% GDP to 5% GDP. And who's going to go against it? You're going to have a handful of Republican cranks and a handful of Democratic loons, right? As the media will portray them, who will go against that. But the rest of the uniparty of the Democrats and Republicans will vote for that. What president is not going to continue to increase the military budget in the United States? It's just impossible to imagine that. You know, this idea of Germany going to war with Russia, of course, which means NATO goes to war with Russia. How much of this, like some of the other things we've been talking about, become self-fulfilling prophecies? And what you have, maybe, if you really want to talk about Machiavellian, is maybe this idea in Germany to hold America's tension in Europe. And I'm being very US-centric here now, of course, but hold US attention to Europe, because it's very clear that there are more Americans in the elites, more Americans in the power structure, et cetera, want war with China than they want war with Russia. I mean, we certainly have those who are tied to this war with Russia, but there are more who favor this idea, who think that the right war, the war we always needed, has been the war with China. I mean, this goes back decades. You know, I remember hearing this in the early 2000s, and certainly when the Bush administration comes in 2001, China is at the top of their list, if people remember. I mean, that's what Condi Rice and others are talking about, the danger of China. We need to confront China. I remember, you know, where I was when I heard the United States was sending two aircraft carriers under the Bill Clinton administration to the Taiwan Straits, right? I mean, like, so this is something that's been since the end of the Cold War, essentially. This has been the focus of American institutions and the people who populate them, of this necessary war with China. And so, you know, I mean, being an American, do I look at this and say, is this an attempt by the Europeans to keep our attention? And I might be completely off base on that. But, you know, certainly you think about that because there are these dueling things. But then, of course, we have those who believe we can do all these wars, right? We could. This goes back to an American military doctrine, 2+1, essentially be able to front, fight and win two major wars and conduct a holding war. In another one, there was an op-ed by a guy named Hockstader. Can't remember his first name. It doesn't matter. In the Washington Post, either and beginning of this week, end of last week, talking about that necessity, the ability for the American military to fight three wars at once. I mean, it's there's no other words to describe it, man, but insanity. That's why. Why do we have to fight three wars at once? Explain that to me. You know, the only reason you want that is because you're either completely on the take with the military-industrial complex or you're a complete ideological fool. You know, and maybe it's both. But that's the only explanation I can come up with why anyone who would pronounce the need for three wars. But then it gets back to this idea we're just talking about, you know, sadists, narcissists, psychopaths, and Machiavellians. And that, you know, you see that play out. But yeah, this thing with Germany and what the Germans have been doing for a number of years. Yeah, I'm sure I'm not the only one who's scratching my head about it.
But if they were Europeans, if they were increased their defense budget from 2% to 5%, let's assume that, and then send this budget to Russia, and if Russia produces these weapons for them, that would be considerable.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's that. Yeah, exactly. That was your thing.
That's not even working.
Yeah, they can't, you know, and here's a Financial Times article. I just read it today, but it came out last week some point, I think May 30th, about, you know, the Czech president, Pavel, had this plan to he was going to go around the world and buy all these artillery shells for Ukraine. And it's not really working out that well. And in the beginning of the article didn't talk about this too much, but I wish it had. That one of the big problems that the Russians are buying those artillery shells before the West can. So the West can't even process bank drafts. Like they can't even pay these nations. Literally, some nation, whoever it is in Africa or Asia or Central South America, wherever they got these artillery shells, the West doesn't even have it together to process bank drafts, you know, the Russians with all the economic sanctions on them being banned from SWIFT and everything else. Somehow the Russians are able to do this in a more expedient manner than the West can. You know, and I was on did another show last week, you know, and I was on with Larry Johnson, you know, and we were talking about this idea of the West fighting Russia, and Larry had to do it from his phone. He got hung up and he had to come in from his phone. And he's like, I'm in Washington, D.C., and I can't even get a good and reliable cell phone, you know, signal. And we're going to fight the Russians? I mean, and that's the case. The United States, I mean, just take one example after another. All these weapon systems that don't work. The F-35, the FMC rate, the full mission capability rate for the F-35 varies between the branches. And for guys and gals who know that full mission capable, you're asking a lot, you know, in the sense of that. But the mission capability rate is barely 50% anyway. But the FMC rate at a program at this point in its maturity, decades you're talking about, for the Air Force variant, it's about 34% or so. So only one third of the F-35s are fully mission capable. For the Marine Corps variant, it was 19%. And for the Navy variant, 14%. So for both the Navy and the Marine Corps, these F-35s, which cost more than $100 million apiece, they're only fully mission capable. Only one out of five of them are. Not even one out of five, because the Navy rate's 14%. I mean, that's just one example. But then you see this Siren Live skit of this the pier that the Americans put off of Gaza, right? That clown show, that circus, costing $300 million. I just read today it's going to cost another $20 to $25 million to fix the pier that got damaged by water. You know, I mean, like, you can't make this stuff up. and somehow we're going to go in and fight the Russians. You know, I mean, the one competent thing, the one smart thing the West has done is the West has not provided their advanced weapon systems to Ukraine. And the French are going to provide Mirages that were built in 1992 or something like that. You know, Mirages that are, many of them are already out of service. You know, these F-16s probably haven't, the Dutch are given, probably haven't been in the sky in 15 years or something like that. You know, they were built in the 80s. The Abrams tanks, we, you know, I mean, the example of this is the U.S. Marine Corps gets rid of all its Abrams tanks. So I forget, we had four tank battalions in the Marine Corps, four times 64 plus training. I mean, you're talking about roughly 300 M1 Abrams tanks, A2 variants that the U.S. Marine Corps divested in the last few years. They're sitting someplace, I don't know, in Barstow or wherever they put them. And why didn't we give those tanks to the Ukrainians? Because we don't want the Russians to know how our systems work. We don't want them to capture them. We don't want them to reverse engineer them. But more importantly, we don't want them to defeat them. And that's this whole notion that somehow these weapons we're providing now, we now are going to allow them to be shot into Russia or somehow are going to matter. It won't. Essentially, the Russians will just adapt to these weapons and they will counter them like they have done throughout the last 26, 27 months. But the only one of the few smart things we have not done has been to provide our more advanced systems, because if we were to go to war with Russia, the Russians would know how all those weapon systems work. And also to the Chinese, because I'm sure part of this Russian China, blossoming friendship includes deals that the Russians will tell the Chinese what they learn about our weapon systems. I vacillate between Nima describing it either as a strategy of hope or no strategy, and I'm not sure which is the better description or which is the more dangerous description too.
Yeah, Matt, just to wrap up this session, when we look at a bigger picture of what's going on right now in the world, considering what's going on in Ukraine, the tensions in Taiwan, and what's going on in the Middle East, the Ministry of Defense of China recently said that they're going to join the Russian army to defend justice in the world. And here comes the question, what does justice mean in their mind when they're talking about it?
I'm waiting, you know, there are reports that about half of the drones Ukraine is using, particularly their smaller drones, come from China. So I'm waiting for China to stop that, right? I mean, they're making good money. These drones are, and the reason why the Ukrainians use the Chinese drones are they're cheaper, they're more capable, they're more reliable, they're programmable, they can scale them to counter Russian electronic warfare in a way that American and European drones can't be. I mean, there's all kinds of reasons why the Ukrainians are using them. Essentially, I just stop it and say because the Chinese drones are better. But, you know, if those reports are true, that again, up to half, if the Chinese were to pull that out, I mean, that'd be really pulling a rug out from underneath Ukraine. And so, like so many other things about our dependence on the West, on other markets for the things we need, including through industry and manufacturing. China is a larger manufacturer than the entire West put together, you know? And if you look at terms of like in Matt, GDP. Just
do we know where do they get these drones? They get it directly from China?
I don't know if they get them directly from China or not. I'm not sure how it goes about, but the origin of manufacturers, China certainly has to know it. And there's ways that they could try to prevent it if they wanted to. As far as I know, they've not said anything about it. And, you know, these reports are, you know, the reports that have come out of American and British think tanks that have looked at this, and I have no reason to doubt that. And also knowing about American weapon systems, European weapon systems, I have no reason to doubt either that the Chinese drones are better and the Ukrainians are in their right mind to be utilizing those drones as opposed to the NATO drones they could be getting. But, you know, I mean, certainly look at Jeff Sachs just had a piece out yesterday, I think it was, talking about the growth of BRICS, the growth of a multipolar world. He compares GDP, you know, and this is something I think we've not spoken too much about this, but like the size of these economies compared to the size of the Western economies and the growth in these economies, the potential of growth in these non-Western economies compared to the lack of potential for growth in Western economies, as well as the isolating nature of the West. So the more we push people away from us, the more we give reasons to for people to find any way possible to escape our hegemony, right? This idea that somehow we'd be a benevolent empire is just, of course, preposterous. But, you know, we are anything from that. We're not even trying to be that. You know, so we are every day, the West, the American empire is giving people great reason, not just the nations that are underneath, that are dealing with the brunt of our bombs and drones and commandos and such and our sanctions, but all the other nations out there. You know, we're giving them great reason to find ways to get away from us because it's in their very best interest to get away from us. So, I mean, you see this idea that, and I hadn't seen that announcement that China is going to, you know, battle injustice or whatever the phrase was. It scares me, of course, because, of course, my mindset, my conditioning, my experience has been that they will do it the way the American empire. Now, the Chinese are not stupid. They're not fools. They have other interests than the Americans. And so they probably won't do it like the Americans. I'm scared to death they will, but more likely they won't. But still, you then have a clash that can occur between a dying empire that's desperate not to lose its possessions, right? To stave off its own deterioration, its own decline. So how will it fight back? This idea that a dying mule kicks hardest. Right. You know, that in its last moments is when an animal is its most ferocious. And that is when I'm scared to death as we see these other nations rise for, you know, all kinds of reasons. Right. Just because that's the order of things, you know, nations advance, people advance, civilizations advance, societies advance. But also to what we're making, this idea that we have created. And we look at what Russia has done these last several years. Obviously, they prepared very well for this war in Ukraine, militarily and economically. And in the sense that we, all of us in the West who thought that Russia would be easy to push over economically, obviously didn't realize that Russia is a nation that is capable of producing anything. Like in terms of commodities, Russia is like in the top three or four producer of every commodity in the world, I think. You know, I mean, if it comes out of the ground, Russia has it and they have a lot of it. You know what I mean? So like, okay, so who is... Why are we betting against them and then forcing the Russians and the Chinese together in a way that is historic and probably only outmatched in its in the nature of it, in how spectacular that pairing is or became, is the relationship now between Russia and Iran, which, you know, I mean, this idea that Tehran and Moscow are somehow going to become allies. Yeah, you know, no way. You know, oh, well, here they are. And how did that happen? Well, because we pushed them into it. What other options did we give them? And it goes beyond that, of course, too. Again, as the West isolates itself, what then becomes of the West? We have deindustrialized. How do we produce things? I mean, we're basically going to be a weakened, a dying empire that is going to be on an exceedingly accelerating current account deficit, right? I mean, in a sense that we are going to continue, because we can't make things ourselves, we are going to continue have to import things as our economic and financial strength continues to fall. So we are going to be at a great, great disadvantage. And so if we think we have issues with inflation now, wait 10, 20 years from now, as we continue then in the West to deprioritize things like education, healthcare, ensuring that our citizens aren't paying 80-90% of their paychecks to overhead costs, right? We are going to have markedly declining quality of life, as well as a continually declining inferior workforce. So all these decades of not investing in our own people is catching up with us. And our policies then of prioritizing military, prioritizing guns over butter, it's catching up with us. And our policies that are isolating us, whether it's by forcing other nations to create alternatives, to create alliances, to try and get away from us, as well as our own economic policies that have giving us a very bleak future. Right, where somehow we're hoping that this next iteration of the service economy is going to be one that really makes us rich, that's not going to happen. You know what I mean? So, man, one thing after another, and you look at it, you know, like, where are we going to be in 10 years time? You know, and this idea, then getting back to this idea that we're going to fight Russia in 2029, we're going to fight China in 2032 or whatever, it's just absolute madness. But again, like an animal, a dying empire, its most ferocious in its final moments, possibly.